had evidence that Ideed's henchmen were inciting demonstrations, then gunning down their own supporters in order to accuse the UN of genocide. Ideed had certainly used starvation as a weapon against rival clans, hijacking and withholding world food shipments. The warlord also knew the value of terror. Some of the dead Pakistani soldiers had been disemboweled and skinned. Howe was outraged and adamant that Ideed be stopped. The admiral was accustomed to having his way. He wasn't a screamer, but once he bit into something, he held on. Many old Africa hands regarded this trait as ill-suited to this part of the world. In Somalia, warlords who feuded one day could be warm old friends the next. Howe was unyielding. If he lacked the means to remove Ideed, he would get the means. He still had friends, friends in very high places, friends who owed him, who had talked him into this job. One of them was Anthony Lake, President Clinton's national security advisor. Another was Madeleine Albright, America's emissary to the UN, who was an unabashed enthusiast of the New World Ordering. Flush with success against Saddam Hussein and the collapse of the Soviet Union, there were plenty of politicians, diplomats, and journalists with bright hopes for a new millennium of worldwide capitalist free markets. America's unrivaled big stick could right the world's wrongs, feed the hungry, democratize the planet. But the generals, most notably outgoing chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell, demanded more solid reasons for getting their soldiers killed. Howe found some allies in the administration, but strict opposition from the Pentagon brass. When Washington denied Howe's request for Delta in June, he began a fruitless effort to catch Ideed with the forces already in place. At first, to avoid harming innocent people, helicopters with loudspeakers broadcast warnings of impending UN action, a gesture thought ridiculous by most Somalis. After administering such a warning, a multinational force descended on Ideed's compound on June 17th. A house-to-house search was conducted by Italian, French, Moroccan, and Pakistani troops, and an armored cordon was thrown around the site by the French and Moroccans. Ideed easily slipped away. Legend on the streets had the general rolling out under the noses of UN troops on a donkey cart, wrapped up in a sheet like a dead body. The UN was not only incapable of capturing Ideed, they were turning him into a folk hero. The decision to attack the Abdi House on July 12th reflected mounting UN frustration. After the Pakistani ambush, the clan escalated its sniping and mortar attacks. The Turkish commander of UN troops, General Çevik Bir, and his second, U.S. Army Major General Thomas Montgomery, wanted to take the kid gloves off. This would be an attack without warning, a chance to chop off the SNA's head. The clan leadership had taken to meeting regularly at the Abdi House. The plan called for helicopters to encircle it from the air, fire tow missiles and cannons into it, then raid the house to arrest survivors. Howe opposed it. Why, he asked, couldn't troops simply surround the place and order those inside to come out? Or why not just storm the house and arrest everybody? Such approaches would subject the UN forces to too much risk, he was told. None of the units in country were capable of policing a sanitized cordon, so issuing a warning would be self-defeating. The officials would just flee, as Ideed had earlier, and the force lacked the capability to perform the kind of lightning snatch-and-grab tactics used by Delta. When the Pentagon and White House signed off on the attack, Howe relented. The number of Somalis killed in the attack was disputed. Mohammed Hassan Farah, Abdullahi Osoble Barre, Gebdid, and others present claimed 73 dead, including women and children who had been on the building's first floor. They said hundreds were wounded. The reports Howe got after the attack placed the number of dead at 20, all men. The International Committee of the Red Cross set the number of dead at 54, with total casualties at 250. But the dispute over the number of dead Somalis was quickly eclipsed by the deaths of four Western journalists who rushed to the Abdi House to report on the attack, only to be killed by an enraged Somali mob. The journalists' deaths focused worldwide anger on the Somalis, but in Mogadishu, the shock and outrage was over the surprise attack. The massacre bolstered Idid's status and badly undercut the UN's humanitarian image. Moderates opposed to Idid now rallied behind him. From the Habergidir's perspective, the UN, and in particular the United States, had declared war. Howe kept pushing for Delta. It was the clearest way out he could see. At Fort Bragg, teams of Night Stalker pilots and Delta officers worked up a plan in June that would require only about 20 men. They would slip into the country surreptitiously and use the QRF's helicopters and equipment. An intelligence assessment found Idid still making public appearances and moving around Mogadishu with his conspicuous escort of technicals. But through July and most of August, there was no green light from Washington. Howe's pleas won out finally in August, when remote-controlled landmines first killed four American soldiers, and then, 2 weeks later, injured seven more. Vacationing on Martha's Vineyard, President Clinton assented. Delta would go. Idid had become America's white whale. Task Force Ranger arrived on August 23rd with a three-phase mission. Phase 1, which would last until the 30th, was just to get the force up and running. Phase 2, which would last until September 7th, would concentrate exclusively on finding and capturing Idid. The command staff already suspected this would be futile, since widespread publicity about the Rangers' intentions quickly drove Idid underground. Phase 3 would target Idid's command structure. This was the meat of Task Force Ranger's mission. If the D-Boys couldn't catch the warlord, they were going to put him out of business. Howe had initially envisioned a small unit of stealthy operators, but he was delighted to get the whole 450-man task force. He weathered with patience its early missteps. As September rolled on, despite the glitches, the force achieved mounting success. Howe was especially pleased on September 21st, when a surprise daylight assault on a convoy of cars resulted in the capture of Osman Ato, the arms dealer and Idid's chief banker, who was now imprisoned with a growing number of other SNA captives on an island off the coast of the southern port city of Kismayu, in pup tents surrounded by razor wire. Idid was feeling the heat. A Habergidia leader cooperating with U.S. forces told them, "He, Idid, is very tense. The situation out there is very tense." In late August, the Somali warlord sent a letter to former President Jimmy Carter, pleading for him to intervene with President Clinton. The general wanted an independent commission, composed of internationally known statesmen, scholars, and jurists from different countries, to investigate the allegations that he was responsible for the June 5th incident. Idid claimed it had been a spontaneous uprising of Mogadishu citizens who feared the UN was attacking Radio Mogadishu. He also called for a negotiated solution to his standoff with the UN. Carter had taken this message to the White House, and the suggestion was received warmly by Clinton, who directed that efforts to resolve matters peacefully be renewed. The State Department began quietly working on a plan to intercede through the governments of Ethiopia and Eritrea. The plan called for an immediate ceasefire and for Idid to remove himself from Somalia until the international inquiry was done. It set a new round of nation-building talks in November. There were other feelers being put out in Mogadishu by Howe through Habergidir elders, alarmed at the recent turn of events. Howe and his supporters in Washington were convinced that Idid's sudden flexibility was a direct result of Garrison's pressure. Peace had been the reason for Howe's journey this weekend. on his long flight over the dry wasteland, watching the shadow of his plane racing ahead of it across the dunes, he felt like the UN at last was dealing from a position of strength. After circling out over the water for nearly an hour, Howe's plane was finally cleared to land at the Ranger base late Sunday afternoon. He knew there was a battle raging, but he didn't get the full picture until he returned to the UN compound early that evening. General Montgomery was at work there, piecing together an enormous international convoy to go in and rescue the downed Rangers and pilots. There was little for Howe to do but find a place to sit and observe. Montgomery had his hands full. The Malaysians and Pakistanis, who had the necessary armor, wanted no part of the Bakara market. These were the same troops that had effectively backed out of the city streets after the Marines had left. They did want to help, but were balking at the idea of sending big armored vehicles into the hornet's nest. In those densely populated neighborhoods, moving slowly through narrow streets, armor was highly vulnerable. The Italians, whose loyalties had been at best suspect throughout the intervention, were nevertheless ready to commit, as were the Indians, who had tanks of their own they could throw into the fight. It would take longer to get the Italians and Indians into position, so Montgomery was pushing the Malays and Pakis hard. Howe couldn't help but wonder what would have happened if such a determined international response had greeted the June 5th slaughter of the Pakistani troops, as he had urged. Still, he was pleased to see it now. It was a shame the task force had gotten stung, but once the bleeding stopped, maybe there would be more of an appetite in Washington to get rid of this upstart warlord once and for all. Chapter 11. Word that there was big trouble in the city spread quickly through the Somali staff at the U.S. Embassy compound. Abdi Karim Mohammed worked as a secretary for Brown and Root, one of the American companies providing support services to the international military force. He had been a 21-year-old college student when the Barre regime was toppled. He had furthered his education on his own ever since. He wore wire-rimmed glasses, spoke fluent English, wore neatly pressed Oxford blue shirts, and had about him an air of eager, cheerful efficiency that won him increasing responsibility. He was also a pair of smart eyes and ears for the Habergidir, his clan. Abdi had been hopeful about the UN when the humanitarian mission began. He found a job, and the effort seemed good for his country. But when the attacks began on his clan and General Idid, and every week there was a mounting toll of Somali dead and injured, he saw it as an unwarranted assault on his country. On July 12th, the day of the Abdi House attack, he had seen victims of the bombing who were brought to the U.S. Embassy compound. The Somali men, elders of his clan, were bloody and dazed and in need of a doctor. Instead, the Americans photographed them and interrogated them and then put them in jail. Abdi kept his job, but for a different reason. He could hear waves of gunfire crackling over the city and heard the fight was at the Bakara market. At Brown and Root, all Somali employees were sent home. "Something has happened," Abdi was told. Abdi lived with his family between the market and the K-4 traffic circle, which was just north of the Ranger base. The rickety jitneys, so crammed with passengers that the American soldiers called them Klingon cruisers, a nod to Star Trek, were still running up via Lenin. The sounds of gunfire increased, and the sky was thick with helicopters speeding low over the rooftops, flying great looping orbits over the market area. There were bullets snapping over his head when he got home. He found his father there with his two brothers and sister. They were in the courtyard of their home with their backs against a concrete wall, which was the place they always went when bullets flew. It seemed to Abdi that there were 100 helicopters in the sky. The shooting was continual and seemed to be directed everywhere. Aidid's militia would fight from hundreds of places in the densely populated neighborhood, not in any one place. So the fight raged in all directions. As bad as it was, Abdi found that he grew accustomed to the shooting after a while. It all seemed to be passing overhead anyway. After waiting an hour or so with his family against the wall, he grew restless and began moving around the house, looking out windows. Then he ventured outside. Some of his neighbors said the rangers had taken Aidid. Many people were running toward the fight. Abdi wanted to see for himself, so he joined the crowds moving that way. He had relatives who lived just a few blocks from the Olympic Hotel, and he was eager for news of them. With all the bullets and blasts, it was hard to believe anyone in the market area had not been hit. When he got close to the shooting, there was terrible confusion on the streets. There were dead people on the road, men, women, children. Abdi saw an American soldier up one alley, lying by the road, bleeding from the leg and trying to hide himself. When a woman ran out in front of Abdi, the American fired. The woman was hit, but got off the street. Abdi ran around a corner just as one of the little birds zoomed down that alley. He pressed himself against a stone wall and saw bullets kick up in a line at the alley's center toward and then past him. Venturing out like this had been a bad idea. He could not have imagined such madness. After the helicopter passed, a group of Somali men with rifles ran to the corner, trying to find a better angle to shoot at the American. Abdi ran then to the house of a friend. They let him in, and he got on the floor with everyone else. Chapter 12. In the minutes before Super 6-1 was shot down, the Rangers and Delta operators back at the target house had been preparing to leave. It was taking longer than it should have. First, they had the wounded Ranger, Blackburn, who had fallen from a Black Hawk. Three Humvees had been separated from the ground convoy to return Blackburn to base. Sergeant Pilla had been killed on that ride. After those three vehicles departed, the convoy just sat. All of the men had heard veterans talk about the fog of war, which was shorthand for how even the best-laid plans went to hell fast once shooting started. But it was shocking, nevertheless, to see how hard it was to get even the simplest things done. Staff Sergeant Dan Schilling, the Air Force CCT in the convoy's lead Humvee, finally got fed up waiting and went looking for what was holding things up. It turned out the D-boys had been waiting with the prisoners for some signal from the convoy, while the convoy had been waiting for the D-boys to come out. Schilling ran back and forth a few times and finally got things moving. Schilling was a laconic man from Southern California, a lean, athletic former Army reservist who, 8 years earlier, had gambled his pay grade and rank to join the Air Force and see if he could get past the rigorous selection process for combat controllers. It was a quicker path into special ops than any the Army offered, and it sounded like fun. CCTs specialized in dropping into dangerous places and directing pinpoint airstrikes from the ground. Since this mission called for close coordination between forces on the ground and in the air, Schilling had been assigned to ride with the convoy commander, Lieutenant Colonel Danny McKnight. It was exactly the kind of adventure Schilling had sought. He was now 30, a 6-year veteran of special ops, and he was earning his danger pay today. He fidgeted while the flex-cuffed Somalis were packed into one of the flatbeds. The rest of the assault force had set off on foot for the crash site. The longer the convoy waited like this out on the street, the more vulnerable they were. Every minute of delay gave Aidid's militia and the armed mob time to amass. There was a noticeably steady increase in the volume of fire. From the outset, they'd assumed a 30-minute window. If they could get in and out in that time, they'd probably be okay. Schilling looked at his watch. They'd been on the ground now for 37 minutes. Then, Super 6-1 went down, and everything changed. They were ordered to move to the crash site, pronto. There were already wounded men in nearly every vehicle. Thick smoke was in the air, and there was the odor of gunpowder and flames, and up alleys and in the main road, and before some of the buildings, along Holwadig, there were Somali bodies and parts of bodies. There were upended carts and burning, riddled hulks of automobiles. One of the convoy's three flatbed 5-ton trucks was hugely aflame. It had been hit and disabled by an RPG, and a thermite grenade had been ignited to completely destroy it. Big holes had been blasted in the whitewashed cinder block walls of the Olympic Hotel and surrounding buildings. Trees had been leveled with gunfire. In the alleyways and at the intersections, the sandy soil had soaked up pools of blood and turned brown. The noise was deafening, but had increased gradually enough that the men had grown accustomed to it. A loud snap or the chip of nearby stone would signal alarm, but the mere sound of gunfire no longer stopped anyone. They moved cautiously, but without fear in the din. McKnight seemed particularly heedless of the danger. He strode confidently across streets and up to men crouched behind cover as though nothing was out of the ordinary. Shortly, he began waving rangers into the vehicles. "This is Uniform 6-4, McKnight. "I'm ready for exfil. I'm loaded with everything I can get here, and I'm ready to move to the crash site. Over." "Roger, go ahead and move." This from Lieutenant Colonel Gary Harrell, the Delta Squadron commander in the C-2 Blackhawk. "The streets are fairly clear. We've been getting reports of sniper fire from the north of the crash site. Roger, we'll take a right out of here and we'll head down to the crash site to the east. Over." It sounded simple enough. 2 blocks north, 3 blocks east. The convoy started rolling. 6 Humvees and the 2 remaining flatbed trucks. There were 3 Humvees in front of the trucks and 3 behind them. The trucks had big fluorescent orange panels on top to help the surveillance birds track them. The helicopters would be their eyes in the sky, guiding them through the city. They were driving into the bloodiest phase of the battle. Chapter 13. Blackhawk pilot Mike Durant had seen a little bird ascend from the crash site as he swung Super 6-4 back south on its holding pattern. Straight ahead was the bright white front of the Olympic Hotel, one of the city's few tall buildings, which was across the street from the target building. In the far distance was the darkening green of the Indian Ocean. Smoke rose and drifted over the rooftops around the hotel, marking the fight. Black hawks and little birds moved through the dark haze like predatory insects, darting and firing down into the fray. Then he heard the expected radio call for Super 6-8, the CSAR Black Hawk. He watched it swing away south. His own summons from Lieutenant Colonel Matthews in the command bird came moments later. "Super 6-4, this is Alpha 5-1, over." "This is Super 6-4. Go ahead." "Roger 6-4. Come up and join 6-2 in his orbit." "6-4 is inbound." Moving in fast and low over the city, Durant caught glimpses of the action beneath his chopper's chin bubble, through the swirling clouds of smoke and dust. The neat box structure they had outlined earlier, with rangers positioned on all 4 corners of the target block, had completely broken down. It was hard to make sense of the action below. He could see the general area where Elvis's bird had gone in, a dense neighborhood of small stone houses with tin roofs, in a crosshatch of dirt alleyways and wide cross streets. But the crashed Black Hawk was in such a tight spot between houses, he couldn't spot it. He caught glimpses of small ranger columns moving up the dusty alleys, crouching defensively, rifles up and ready, taking cover, exchanging fire with the swarms of Somalis who were also running in that direction. Durant flipped a switch in the cockpit to arm his crew chief's guns, 2 6-barreled 7.62-millimeter miniguns capable of firing 4,000 rounds per minute, but warned them to hold fire until they figured out where all the friendlies were. Durant fell into Elvis's vacant place in a circular pattern opposite Super 6-2, the Black Hawk piloted by Chief Warrant Officer Mike Gofina and Captain Jim Yacone, and began trying to get in sync with them. 6-4, say location, Gofina asked. We are about a mile and a half to your north. 6-4, keep a good eye on the west side. Roger. The idea was to maintain a low cap, a sweeping circle over the battle area. On the radio, Durant heard that the CSAR bird had been hit, but had managed to rope in the rescue team and was still flying. On the radio, Gofina and Yacone were already pointing out targets for Durant's gunners, but it was hard to get visually oriented. Durant's seat was on the right side of the airframe, and he was flying counterclockwise, banking left, so mostly he was seeing sky. It was maddening. When he leveled off, he was flying so low and fast that the view down through the chin bubble was like peering down through a tube. Flashing fast beneath his feet were rusty tin roofs, trees, burning cars, and tires. There were Rangers and darting Somalis everywhere. He couldn't tell if he was being shot at. What with the roar of his engines and the radio din, Durant could never tell for sure if he was being shot at. He assumed he was. Two birds had been hit already. He was doing all this, and listening, and also varying his airspeed and altitude, trying to make his Black Hawk a more challenging target. It was on his fourth or fifth circle, just as things were starting to make sense below, that he felt his chopper hit something hard, like an invisible speed bump. Chapter 14. After they had delivered Private Blackburn, the ranger who had fallen from the helicopter, to the small rescue column that would return him to base, Sergeants Jeff McLaughlin and Casey Joyce had set off north on Holwadig to rejoin their element, Chalk 4. They hadn't gotten far. They were distracted by a gunman down an alley who would pop out to shoot and then duck back before they could return fire. McLaughlin covered the alley so Joyce could scamper across. Then they both got down on one knee at opposite sides of it, waiting to nail this guy. From a distance, all the Somali fighters looked the same. Skinny black guys with dusty bushes of hair, long baggy pants, and loose oversized shirts. While most of them would wildly spray bullets and then run, some were fiercely persistent. Occasionally, one would run right out into the open, blazing away, and invariably be mowed down. This one was smart. He would lean out just long enough to take aim and shoot, then duck back behind the corner. McLaughlin tried to anticipate him. The shooter's head would appear, the sergeant would squeeze off a well-aimed round, and the man would duck away again. McLaughlin was determined to get him. He stayed down on one knee, around a corner, trying to hold his M16 perfectly steady, drawing a bead on the spot down the alley where the shooter would briefly appear. Sweat stung the sergeant's eyes. He grew so absorbed in this fruitless duel that he lost track of time and place, and was startled when a platoon sergeant yelled his name. "Hey, Mac, come on!" The convoy was moving on the street behind him, rolling north on Holwadig. Everybody seemed to be on it except him. He looked over for Joyce, and he was gone too. He had already climbed into a vehicle. McLaughlin crossed the road and trotted along on the far side of one Humvee, past the contested alley. The Humvee was full. "Jump on the hood!" shouted one of the men inside. McLaughlin got one long leg up before it occurred to him that this was a bad idea. Vehicles were bullet magnets. He pictured himself threading through this deadly madness, spread-eagled on top of a Humvee. It was bad enough to be in one of these streets, and quite another to be a 6-5 Ranger bullseye mounted on top. He ran around the vehicle and opened the door, and insisted that Private Tory Carlson shove over. Carlson did, and McLaughlin crawled on the seat and set his M16 on the rim of the open right rear window. About 100 yards farther up, the convoy came upon the remainder of Sergeant Eversman's beleaguered Chalk IV. Eversman and his men had been pinned down ever since Blackburn fell from the chopper. They had seen the helicopter crash. When he pulled himself up to his considerable height, Eversman could see the wreckage of Super 6-1 from one of the angled alleys leading east. Captain Steele had radioed with orders for the sergeant to move his chalk down to it on foot. "Roger," Eversman had said, meaning like, "Yeah, right." There was little chance of their moving anywhere. In the distance, he could already see men in helmets and flak vests and desert uniforms around the wreckage, so he knew Americans had gotten there. They were near enough for him to instruct his men to hold their fire in that direction. He was down to only about 4 or 5 men who could still fight. The convoy arrived like an answer to his liftoff Hail Mary. Eversman saw his friend Sergeant Mike Pringle in the turret of McKnight's lead Humvee, working the 50 cal hard, with his head down so far he was actually peering out under the gun. It brought a smile to Eversman's face in spite of everything. "Hey, Sergeant, get in. We're driving to the crash site," shouted McKnight. "Captain Steele wants us to move over on foot. It's right down there," said Eversman, pointing. "I know," said McKnight. "Get in. We're driving over." Schilling provided covering fire up Holwadig as Eversman and his men moved across the road. The chalk leader herded his men aboard the crowded vehicles, loading the wounded first, literally piling them in the back on top of other guys, then finding room for the others. He was the last man standing on the street as McKnight shouted for him to hurry up. Eversman checked off the list of names in his head, determined to account for every man in his chalk. He'd lost track of McLaughlin and Joyce, and the medics he'd sent off with Blackburn, but they were not at his intersection or anywhere down the block. The column was rolling again. There was nothing for him to do but leap on the back of one. He landed on somebody and found himself flat on his back, looking up at the sky, moving through the streets with Somalis still shooting at them, realizing what a terrific target he was and that he couldn't even return fire. "I'm going to get shot, and there isn't a damn thing I can do about it." As helpless as he felt, he was relieved to be back with the others and moving. If they were together and rolling, it meant the end was near. The crash site was just blocks away. Then he would position himself better for the ride out. While Eversman had been loading his men, Schilling ran out to the middle of the road to gather up Chalk IV's 2 fast ropes, which were still stretched across Holwadig. The task force had been drilled to recover the 3-inch-thick ropes, which were hard to replace. Despite the gunfire, he fetched one. It was hard work hauling it back, and he was already sweaty and dirty and tired. So Schilling asked John Gay, a SEAL in the Humvee behind his, if he'd help him with the other. Gay was crouched behind cover, returning fire. He gave Schilling a shocked stare, and then rolled his eyes. "Forget the fucking ropes," he shouted. It dawned on Schilling that he'd just risked his life for a long strand of braided nylon. He got back into the Humvee, wondering at himself. As the convoy started up again, the gunfire was heavier than ever. Rounds pinged off the armored sides of the vehicles, and every few minutes the wobbly smoke trail of an RPG would zip past. Schilling spotted a donkey tied to an olive tree in an alleyway. The animal stood perfectly still in the maelstrom, clearly distressed. Long ears folded back, and tail pointing straight down. He'd seen the donkey when they first pulled up, and assumed it would eventually be hit. As they pulled away, he caught another glimpse of it, still standing stock still, unscathed. Nobody in the rear vehicles knew where they were going. Many of the men didn't know that a helicopter had been shot down. One who did not was Eric Spaulding, the ranger who had designed the successful rat trap back in the hangar. Spaulding was in the passenger seat in the cab of the second truck, the one with the prisoners. He assumed when they began moving, that was it. The mission was over. They were on their way home. Driving was Specialist John Maddox. They had the front windshield flipped up and out so Spaulding could shoot forward. He leaned his M16 out the truck window. Although an expert marksman, he was no longer just squeezing off one careful round after the next. There were too many targets, too many people shooting at him. It was as if Kill an American Day had been declared in Moog. It seemed like every man, woman, and child in the city was out trying to get them. There were people in alleyways, in windows, on rooftops. Spaulding kept shooting his rifle dry. Then he would shoot with his 9mm Beretta pistol with one hand while he replaced the rifle magazine with the other. He just wanted to get the hell out of there. When the column took a turn to the right, he wondered what was up. The mission is over. Why aren't we going back? There wasn't enough time to find somebody to ask. After going 2 blocks east, the convoy made another right turn. They'd lost track of the men moving to the crash site on foot. Now the convoy was bearing south, heading toward the back end of the target house and toward National Street, the paved road they'd come in on. At least Spaulding thought that was where they were headed. Most of the streets in Mogadishu looked the same, rutted orange sand with big gouges in the middle and tremendous mounds of debris, shabbily mortared stone walls on both sides, stubby olive trees and cactus bushes, and crisscrossing dirt alleys. The intersections were the problem. Every time the truck approached an alley, Spaulding would lie out across the warm hood and just open up as they rolled through. He could hear nothing but the sound of automatic weapons fire and bullets snapping around him and pinging off the truck. A woman in a flowing purple robe darted past on the driver's side of the truck. Maddox had his pistol resting on his left arm, pretty much shooting at whatever moved. "Don't shoot!" Spaulding shouted. "She's got a kid!" The woman abruptly turned. Holding the baby in one arm, she raised a pistol with her free hand. Spaulding shot her where she stood. He shot 4 more rounds into her before she fell. He hoped he hadn't hit the baby. They were moving, and he couldn't see if he had or not. He thought he probably had. She had been carrying the baby on her arm right in front. Why would a mother do something like that with a kid on her arm? What was she thinking? Spaulding couldn't get over it. Maybe she was just trying to get away, saw the truck, panicked, and raised the gun. There wasn't time to fret over it. Chapter 15 Blackhawk pilot Mike Gofina was coming up behind Mike Durant's Super 6-4 when the grenade hit. It blew a chunk off the tail rotor. Gofina saw all the oil dump out of it in a fine mist, but the mechanism stayed intact, and everything seemed to still be functioning. 6-4, are you okay? Gofina asked. The Black Hawk is a heavy aircraft. Durant's weighed about 16,000 pounds at that point, and the tail rotor was a long way from where he sat. The question came before he had even figured out what happened. Gofina explained that he had been hit by an RPG and that there was damage to the tail area. Roger, Durant radioed back coolly. Nothing felt abnormal about the bird at first. He did a quick check of all his instruments, and the readings were all okay. His crew chiefs, Cleveland and Field, were unhurt in the back. So after the initial shock, Durant felt relief. Everything was fine. Gofina told him he had lost his oil and part of the gearbox on the tail rotor, but the sturdy Black Hawk was built to run without oil for a time if necessary, and it was still holding steady. Matthews, the air mission commander, had also seen the hit from his seat in the orbiting C-2 bird. He told Durant to put the Black Hawk on the ground, so the pilot of the stricken chopper pulled out of his left-turning orbit and pointed back to the airfield, about a 4-minute flight southwest. Durant could see the base off in the distance against the coastline. He noted, just to be safe, that there was a big green open area about halfway there, so if he had to land sooner, he had a place to put it. But the bird was flying fine. Gofina followed Durant for about a mile, to a point where he felt confident Super 6-4 would make it back. He had just started to turn around when Durant's tail rotor, the whole thing, the gearbox and 2 or 3 feet of the vertical fin assembly, just turned into a blur and evaporated. Inside Super 6-4, Durant and co-pilot Ray Frank felt the airframe begin to vibrate. They heard the accelerating high-speed whine of the dry gear shaft in its death throes. Then came a very loud bang as it blew apart. With the top half of the tail fin gone, a big weight was suddenly dropped off the airframe's back end. Its center of gravity pitched violently forward, and the bird began to spin. After a decade of flying, both Durant's and Frank's reactions were instinctive. To make the airframe swing left meant pushing gently on the left foot pedal. Durant now noticed he had already jammed his left pedal all the way to the floor, and his craft was still spinning rapidly to the right. With no tail rotor, there was no way to stop it. The spin was faster than Durant ever imagined it could be. Details of earth and sky blurred like patterns on a spinning top. Out the windshield, he saw just blue sky and brown earth. Durant tried to do something with the flight controls. Frank, in the seat next to him, had the presence of mind to do exactly the right thing. The power control levers for the engines were on the ceiling of the cockpit. Frank had to fight the spin's strong centrifugal force to raise his arms. In those frantic seconds, he somehow managed to pull one lever back, shutting off one engine, and to pull the other one halfway back. Durant shouted into his radio, "Going in hard! Going down! Ray!" The plummeting helicopter's spin rate suddenly slowed. Just before impact, its nose pulled up. Whether for some aerodynamic reason or something Durant or Frank did inside the cockpit, the falling chopper leveled off. With the spin rate down to half what it had been, and with the craft fairly level, the Black Hawk made a hard but flat landing. Flat was critical. It meant there was a chance the men in the helicopter were still alive. Chapter 16. Yusuf Dahir Mualim was near the man who fired the grenade. Mualim was behind a tree in an alley that went behind the Bar Bakin Hotel, a smaller white stone building that was one block south of the Olympic Hotel. He ducked behind the tree to hide from the Black Hawk overhead. As he did, one of his men, part of a group of 26 militia who had come running from the neighboring village of Holwadigli, dropped to one knee in the middle of the alley and pointed up his Russian anti-tank weapon. The tube had been fitted with a metal funnel, which was welded on the back end at an angle to direct the back blast away from the shooter's body. "If you miss, I've got another round," Mualim shouted. They were veteran fighters, guns for hire mostly, although everybody was now fighting the Americans for free. Mualim's father had died in 1984 in fighting between Somalia and Ethiopia, and at age 15, the son was recruited to take his place. He was a skeletal young man, lost in oversized shirt and pants, with deep hollow cheeks and a goatee that filled out his narrow chin. He had fought for 2 years as one of Siad Barre's soldiers, but as the tide of that insurrection changed, he had slipped away from his unit to join Aidid's rebel troops. He was a veteran of many street fights, but none as fierce as this. He had organized the men in his village, a labyrinth of twisting, cactus-lined dirt paths around rag huts and tin-roofed shanties just south of the Bakara market area, into an irregular militia for hire. They remained primarily allied to Aidid because they belonged, as he did, to the Habergidir clan. Mainly, they defended their village from other marauding bands of young fighters. They provided security for anybody willing to pay, including, at times, the UN and other international organizations. Occasionally, they went looking for loot themselves. Men like Mo'alim and his crew were called Murian, or bandits. They lived by the gun, mostly M-16s and the Russian AK-47s that could be bought at the market for a million Somali shillings, or about $200. They also carried anti-tank weapons, everything from World War II-era bazookas to the more reliable and accurate Russian-made RPGs. They took payment for their services in rice or kat. The drug took its toll. Another word for the Murian was dai-dai, or quick-quick, for their jumpy ways and nervous tics. They were fearless fighters, and they often died young. But these days, all the Murian in southern Mogadishu had a common enemy. Some had begun calling themselves, in a play on the word rangers, revengers. They knew the best way to hurt the Americans was to shoot down a helicopter. The helicopters were a symbol of UN power and Somali helplessness. When the Rangers arrived, they had seemed invincible. The Black Hawks and Little Birds were all but invulnerable to the small arms that made up most of the Somali arsenal. They were designed to punish with impunity from a distance. The Rangers, when they came, descended from helicopters quickly, grabbed their captives, and were gone before a significant force could be formed to fight them. When they traveled on the ground, it was in armed convoys that moved fast. But every enemy advertises his weakness in the way he fights. To Aidid's fighters, the Rangers' weakness was apparent. They were not willing to die. Somalis were famous for braving enemy fire, for almost suicidal frontal assaults. They were brought up in clans and named for their fathers and grandfathers. They entered a fight with cunning and courage and gave themselves over to the savage emotion of it. Retreat, even before overwhelming enemy fire, was considered unmanly. For the clan, they were always ready to die. To kill Rangers, you had to make them stand and fight. The answer was to bring down a helicopter. Part of the Americans' false superiority, their unwillingness to die, meant they would do anything to protect each other, things that were courageous but also sometimes foolhardy. Aidid and his lieutenants knew that if they could bring down a chopper, the Rangers would move to protect its crew. They would establish a perimeter and wait for help. They would probably not be overrun, but they could be made to bleed and die. Aidid's men received some expert guidance in shooting down helicopters from fundamentalist Islamic soldiers smuggled in from Sudan, who had experience fighting Russian helicopters in Afghanistan. In the effort, they had resolved to focus their entire arsenal of RPGs, the most powerful weaponry left Aidid after the summer's air attacks on his tanks and big guns. This was problematic. The grenades burst on impact, but it was hard to hit a moving target with one. So the detonators on many were replaced with timing devices to make them explode in midair. That way, they wouldn't need a direct hit to cripple a chopper. Their fundamentalist advisors taught them that the helicopter's tail rotor was its most vulnerable spot. So they learned to wait until it passed over, and to shoot up at it from behind. It was awkward and dangerous to point the tubes at the sky, and suicidal to aim from rooftops. The helicopters spotted an armed man on a rooftop quickly, usually before he had a chance to aim his weapon and fire. So Aidid's fighters devised methods to safely shoot up from the ground. They dug deep holes in the dirt streets. The shooter would lie supine with the back of the tube pointed down into the hole. Sometimes he would cut down a small tree and lean it into the hole, then cover himself with a green robe so he could lie under the tree waiting for one to fly over. They hit their first Black Hawk in the dark early morning of September 25th, but it wasn't part of a ranger mission. The success heartened them. The next time the Rangers came out in force, they would be ready. They would only have to hit one. When Mo'alim heard the helicopters come in low on October 3rd, he grabbed his M16 and rounded up his gang. They ran north, fanning out into groups of 7 or 8, up past National Street and around behind the Olympic Hotel, moving through neighborhoods they knew well. The sky was infested with helicopters. Mo'alim's smaller groups tried to stay together in the crowds of people moving that way. Surrounded by unarmed civilians, they knew the Americans would be less likely to shoot at them, even if they were spotted. They wore sheets and towels thrown over their shoulders to cover their weapons and carried their automatic rifles stiffly at their sides. They were one of many militia gangs moving quickly to the fight. Mo'alim's group first encountered rangers at an intersection in a Humvee just south of the hotel on Holwadig Road. As they crept up and fired on the Americans, a helicopter appeared and opened fire, killing the eldest of Mo'alim's squad, a portly middle-aged man they called Alcohol. Mo'alim dragged Alcohol's limp body off the street, and his squad regrouped a block further south, behind the Barbakin Hotel. It was there that they watched the first helicopter go down. The men cheered wildly. They continued moving and shooting, staying about 2 blocks away from the rangers. They were still south of the target building when one of Mo'alim's group knelt in the road, took aim at another Black Hawk, and fired. The grenade hit the rear rotor, and big chunks of it flew off in the explosion. And then, for a few instants, nothing happened. It seemed to Mo'alim that the helicopter crashed very slowly. It flew on for a while like it had not been damaged, and then abruptly tilted forward and started to spin. It fell in Wadigli, a crowded neighborhood just south of his own. The crash brought cries of exultation from the crowd. All around him, Mo'alim saw people reverse direction. Moments before, the crowd and the fighters had been moving north toward the Olympic Hotel and to where the first Black Hawk had crashed. Now, everyone around him was racing south. He ran with them, back through his own neighborhood of Holwadigli, a goateed veteran soldier waving his weapon and shouting, "Turn back! Stop! There are still men inside who can shoot!" Some listened to him and fell in behind Mo'alim and his men. Others ran on ahead. Ali Hussein, who managed a pharmacy near where the helicopter crashed, saw many of his neighbors grab guns and run toward it. He caught hold of the arm of his friend, Ali Mohammed Kowale, who owned the Black Sea restaurant. Kowale had a rifle. Hussein grabbed him by both shoulders. "It's dangerous! Don't go!" he shouted at him. But the smell of blood was in the air. Kowale wrestled away from Hussein and joined the running crowd. Chapter 17. In ordinary circumstances, as close to the first crash as they were, the convoy would have just barreled over to it, running over and shooting through anything in its path. But with all the help overhead, Task Force Ranger was about to demonstrate how too much information can hurt soldiers on a battlefield. High in the C-2 Black Hawk, Harrell and Matthews could see one group of about 15 gunmen racing along streets that paralleled the 8-vehicle convoy. The running Somalis could keep pace with the vehicles because the trucks and Humvees stacked up at every intersection. Each driver waited until the vehicle in front completely cleared the crossfire before sprinting through it himself. To get stuck in the open was suicidal. Every time the convoy stalled, it gave the bands of shooters time to reach the next street and set up an ambush for each vehicle as it gunned through. The convoy was getting riddled. From above, Harrell and Matthews could see roadblocks and places where Somalis had massed to ambush, so they steered the convoy away from those places. There was an added complication. Flying about 1,000 feet over the C-2 helicopter was the Navy Orion spy plane, which had surveillance cameras that gave them a clear picture of the convoy's predicament. but the Orion pilots were handicapped. They were not allowed to communicate directly with the convoy. Their directions were relayed to the commander at the JOC, who would then radio Harrell in the command bird. Only then was the plane's advice relayed down to the convoy. This built in a maddening delay. The Orion pilots would see a direct line to the crash site. They'd say, "Turn left." But by the time that instruction reached McKnight in the lead Humvee, he had passed the turn. Heeding the belated direction, they then turned down the wrong street. High above the fight, commanders watching out of their windows or on screens couldn't hear the gunfire and screaming of wounded men or feel the impact of the explosions. From above, the convoy's progress seemed orderly. The visual image didn't always convey how desperate the situation really was. Eversman, still lying helplessly on his back toward the rear of the column, had felt the vehicle turn right after leaving his blocking position, which he expected. He knew the crash site was just a few blocks that way. But when the Humvee made the second right-hand turn, it surprised him. Why were they headed south? It was easy to get lost in Mog. The streets weren't laid out like some urban planner's neat grid. Roads you thought were taking you one place would suddenly slant off in a different direction. There were more turns. Soon, the crash site that had been close enough for Eversman to see from his spot on Holwadig Road was lost somewhere back in the hornet's nest. The convoy was bearing south when Durant's helicopter crashed. Up in the lead Humvee, McKnight got the word on the radio from Lieutenant Colonel Harrell.
"Danny, we just had another Hawk go down to RPG fire south of the Olympic Hotel. We need you to get everybody in that first crash site. Need QRF to give us some help. Over."
"This is uniform. Understand. Aircraft down south of Olympic Hotel. Recon and see what we can do after that."
"We're going to try to get the QRF to give us some help. Try to get everyone off that crash site," Super 6-1. "And let's get out of here, down to the other Hawk, and secure it. Over."
It wasn't going to be easy. McKnight was supposed to take this convoy, with the prisoners and the wounded, move to the first crash site, and link up with the bulk of the force there. There was not enough room on the packed Humvees and trucks for the men he already had. Yet the immediate plan called for the convoy to load everyone and proceed south to the second crash site, covering the same treacherous ground they were rolling through now. They pushed on. Heavy fire and mounting casualties took their toll on the men in the vehicles. Some of the slightly wounded men in Eversman's vehicle seemed to be in varying degrees of paralysis, as if their role in the mission had ended. Others were moaning and crying with pain. They were still a long way from the base. The state of things infuriated Sergeant Matt Ryerson, leader of the Delta team that had taken the prisoners. Ryerson's team was with the prisoners on the second truck. Ryerson didn't know where the convoy was going. It was standard operating procedure for every vehicle in a convoy to know its destination. That way, if the lead vehicle got hit or took a wrong turn, the whole convoy could continue. But McKnight, a lieutenant colonel more used to commanding a battalion than a line of vehicles, hadn't told anyone. Ryerson watched as inexperienced Ranger Humvee drivers would stop after crossing an intersection, trapping the vehicles behind them in the crossfire. Whenever the convoy stopped, Ryerson would hop down and move from vehicle to vehicle, trying to square things away. As they passed back behind the target house, an RPG scored a direct hit on the third Humvee in the column, the one McLaughlin had squeezed into. Private Carlson, who had moved over to make room for the sergeant, heard the pop of a grenade being launched nearby. Then came a blinding flash, an ear-shattering boom. The inside of the Humvee filled with black smoke. The goggles Carlson had pinned to the top of his helmet were blown off. The grenade had cut straight through the steel skin of the vehicle in front of the gas cap and gone off inside, blowing the three men in back right out to the street. It tore the handguards off McLaughlin's weapon and pierced his left forearm with a chunk of shrapnel. He felt no pain, just some numbness in his hand. He told himself to wait until the smoke cleared to check it out. The shrapnel had fractured a bone in his forearm, severed a tendon, and broken a bone in his hand. It wasn't bleeding much, and he could still shoot. Holding his breath in the dark cloud, his ears ringing, Carlson felt himself for wet spots.